TexasObserver.org, you're listening to Observer Radio. I'm your host, Jonathan McNamara. This is a half-hour news show in which we ask the Texas Observer staff to take a break from writing and say things to you on the radio instead. Back in the studio with us this week is Observer staff writer Patrick Michaels. Welcome back, Patrick.
Hi, Jonathan.
Later in the show, we'll be joined by Observer contributor Alex Hannaford and photographer Aaron Treib to talk about their latest Observer story, Hope After Violence. The story looks at women veterans and the particular challenges they face dealing with trauma when they come home. But before we get to that, we've got a lot to discuss this week about compounding pharmacies. Patrick, what do compounding pharmacies want from Attorney General Greg Abbott?
Well, that's the big question. Now, there was a report from the watchdog here in Austin, Texans for Public Justice, that noted that Greg Abbott's number one campaign contributor is a guy named Richie Ray.
Right. $350,000.
And more. I mean, going back to when he was running for attorney general early on, Mr. Ray has been a big backer of his. But lately, the pace has picked up to the tune of $250,000 in a single donation just recently. So you look at that and you say, well, what's going on? I mean, sometimes you can understand a guy who runs a petrochemical plant, wants to donate a lot of money. Okay, maybe wants a little more freedom to do that.
Or sure.
Oil and gas company or home builders want laws that benefit them. So a compounding pharmacist, what do you want? A compounding pharmacy is basically what you imagine like old-timey pharmacists doing, mixing up the drugs in the back room and, all kinds of funny colors and stuff. And
right.
So, there are big drug manufacturers that like Pfizer would use. And then a lot of times there are still these smaller drug mixers out there for all kinds of reasons. And, for pets, drugs for pets are often made at compounding pharmacies. Sometimes they're made like they make lollipops of medicine for kids so they don't have to swallow a pill.
Handy.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes they make the drugs that are used to carry out the death penalty here in Texas.
Right.
Or around the country. And
sure.
Pentobarbital is the one that Texas uses now. And famously last fall, the source of that drug was revealed to be the Woodlands Compounding Pharmacy, which is not a huge operation. They sure got a lot of flack once everyone found out it was them. They were not very happy to be revealed as the source, and they started getting protests. They lost business. They said they got death threats because of being the ones. And they basically asked the state to get the drugs back so that they could just sort of wipe the slate clean. And the state said no. The state has now lined up a new supplier for its death penalty drugs, and the Attorney General Greg Abbott has reversed course and said, now that we don't have to tell you, actually. It's not public information
what
the source of the drugs are. It was last fall. Mm-hmm. Now it's different. What he says is different is basically in response to the stuff in the Woodlands. He got the director of the Texas Department of Public Safety, Steve McCraw, to do a threat assessment of this. And he wrote a three-paragraph letter that said, we looked at it. Yep, these are credible threats. It seems like a bad idea to release the names of this pharmacy.
Right.
And so now there's an attorney general ruling saying that you don't have to release the name of the pharmacy. That happened right around the same time, I believe just after that $250,000 donation from Richie Ray, who has a compounding pharmacy right near there. It's in Conroe. It's near the Woodlands.
Yeah.
So one of the theories is that he's pouring all this money in because he's trying to keep the death penalty drugs, the source of those, anonymous. As Alex knows, that's a big issue all around the country. Compounding pharmacies are being used a lot more to carry out death penalties, I guess because other drug suppliers don't want to do it.
Yeah, I mean, I think also the interesting thing is how the sort of human rights organizations and death penalty attorneys have sort of thwarted at every it's sort of like a cat and mouse game, a very bizarre cat and mouse game. So, a pharmacist in the UK, for example, will start supplying the drugs. A human rights charity, their team of lawyers will find out who it is, and then they'll expose them in the media, send them, letters saying how awful this is, and suddenly they'll get so much flack that they'll stop doing it. So it's literally been this kind of weird cat and mouse game, I think.
And the big game is sort of outing the pharmacy that supplies the drugs.
Yeah, exactly.
That's a big deal in Texas. And just to give you a sense of the scope here, I mean, one of the things that people are trying to figure out, well, who is supplying these drugs now? There are 3,330 compounding pharmacies in the state, but some of those are like Walgreens that's going to mix in some, some grape flavor or something into the medicine for the kids. Sure.
Yeah.
You're, I think, probably in the minority in that.
But well, you know, I like to break the mold.
It's traditional. Though.
Yeah.
That's true. But they're also, they go up in levels of sterility, which is how you measure, you know, how clean the drugs are. If it's going to be injected into somebody, say, you know, a prisoner on death row, you're going to go with a high level of sterility. And there are only 138 pharmacies that meet that level in Texas. So all of a sudden, you've narrowed it down quite a bit.
Yeah.
One of those is the Woodlands Compounding Pharmacy, and it's not going to be them anymore. So that's 137. So I imagine that lawyers out there who are trying to figure this out, you know, might be looking at that short list.
Patrick, thanks for sharing that story.
Yeah, thanks.
We're recording this episode on Thursday, June 5th, the first day of the Republican State Convention in Fort Worth. We've sent Observer politics writer Chris Hooks there to cover the convention. Chris, thank you for taking time away from your assignment to speak with us.
Hey, Jonathan. Happy to do it.
So let's talk about the convention so far and some of the newer members of the GOP that are showing their faces there. Who's in attendance?
Well, this is really a transitional moment for the state Republican Party. Given how long that they've been in office, you might think that each convention is more about continuity than change, but there really is kind of a generational shift happening now in the party. You have older figures like, figures that are still with us, but Governor Rick Perry, Lieutenant Governor David Dewhurst, and Attorney General Greg Abbott are all kind of, they're changing their positions. Greg Abbott, obviously, is probably still going to be with us. He's running for governor, but this is the last state Republican convention where Rick Perry will be in office, and now we know the last one where David Dewhurst will be in office. David Dewhurst actually is not even coming. He had a contentious primary fight with Dan Patrick, of course.
Right.
And he flew off to France, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah, good man.
So we started the convention with kind of a Rick Perry swan song, I guess you could say. A long video montage about his career and highlighting some of his achievements, kind of stepping away from some of the red meat stuff, clearly preparing to run for president in 2016. And that was one of the first items on the agenda for the for the convention, and they've kind of stepped away from him now. So now our attention is turning to Dan Patrick, Lieutenant Governor nominee Dan Patrick, who's now, I think you would have to say, one of the top figures in the state Republican Party. And the slate of candidates that came in with him on last week's primary ballot. So people like Agriculture Commissioner nominee Sid Miller, the Attorney General candidate Ken Paxton, figures who are of a very kind of different vintage than the people that they're replacing, much more in tune with the Tea Party, and they've kind of emerged from a different era of conservative politics in Texas.
Chris, I was there 2 years ago, and it was before the runoff between Ted Cruz and David Dewhurst for the U.S. Senate. But it was clear just looking at the stickers everyone had around and the T-shirts they were wearing and the way that he was received on stage that Ted Cruz was really the big star. And I'm wondering if it's possible to say at this point, is Dan Patrick the new Ted Cruz there, or is there anybody else who you really see is sort of like the most popular kid around?
Well, it's interesting. If you walk around the trade show where a lot of candidates have booths, it seems like the most popular product is still Ted Cruz. It seems like he is remaining the vintage for a lot of people, but there's definitely a lot of excitement around Dan Patrick here. You see a lot of people with Dan Patrick buttons, and Dan Patrick came through a very contentious primary fight, and there's really no hint of any of that kind of hanging over now. People really do seem to have rallied around him. I think one difference maybe that you could make between Dan Patrick and Ted Cruz is Ted Cruz felt very much more like he was an individual. The kind of movement around him when he was running for Senate, it was about him, his personality, his ability as a candidate. And I think when you look at Dan Patrick, he's a figure that a lot of people are getting very excited about, but he's also coming in with a slate of candidates. And it feels kind of, if the Tea Party movement, or however you'd like to describe them, won an election with Ted Cruz, they're winning a lot of them now. And it seems like a change that's kind of more about changing this whole institution of the Republican Party and not so much about that one very exciting race.
Well, Chris, thanks for calling in. I look forward to seeing your reporting.
Okay, thanks so much.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Observer Radio, a half-hour news show from the folks at the Texas Observer. Although it's rarely talked about, women are more than twice as likely as men to have PTSD. Women veterans, in particular, are the silent sufferers in the aftermath of America's military adventures in the Middle East. The nature of America's 21st century wars means more women are experiencing the ravages of war while enduring sexual harassment and assault. In their story, Hope After Violence, Observer contributing writer Alex Hannaford investigates the particular challenges women dealing with trauma face when they come home and profiles the survivors who are trying to change the system. Joining us to talk about this story is Alex Hannaford himself and photographer Aaron Treib. Thanks to both of you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Alex, just starting out, can you give us sort of a general sense of your story?
Yeah, so just under 8% of Americans will experience PTSD at some stage in their life. But for the veterans of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, that rises to about 20%. And in the general population, including veterans, women are about twice as likely to develop PTSD than men. But what was interesting, as part of this story, we looked at three Texas newspapers, the Statesman in Austin, the Dallas Morning News, and the Houston Chronicle over the last 3 years, and looked at coverage of PTSD among veterans. And we found that 73% of stories about veterans with PTSD were solely about men, and 6% were exclusively about women. So there's, silent sufferers is right. I just don't think people or we hear enough about women and PTSD, and in this case, veterans.
I'd like to hit on that a little bit more. Why is it that we don't hear more about women veterans with PTSD? Why is it so focused on the men?
I think it's because the majority of military service members who experience combat are infantry soldiers or Marines, and women aren't allowed in the infantry. So I think the public perception is that the boots on the ground, the service members who go out and do the fighting are the ones that are basically being diagnosed with PTSD. But I think it's a myth. Calculation, because a lot of women experience PTSD in the military, overseas, and also stateside. There's combat medics, there's women who are attached to infantry units, there's women who are serving in operating rooms, who assist on rescue missions, and all of those activities in the theater of war also involve trauma. So I think that's why people mostly focus on men instead of women.
I think also in the story I cite a statistic, some statistics from the Service Women's Action Network, and they actually submitted two Freedom of Information requests. That showed that the Department of Veterans Affairs were more likely to approve claims for PTSD caused by combat, which is what Aaron was just talking about,
right,
than claims for PTSD caused by sexual trauma, which is known by its acronym MST, military sexual trauma. And so what this showed, I mean, just give you one of those statistics. The Waco VA, for example, in 2012, 75% of combat PTSD claims were approved versus 67% of MST PTSD claims. The year before that, in 2011, the Waco VA approved 77% of combat claims, but just 47% of military sexual trauma PTSD claims. And of course, those percentages should be the same. I mean, the PTSD is the same. You've still got PTSD, whether it's caused by military sexual trauma or combat. So there's, I think, a reluctance, not just to sort of diagnose that, but also in the media, it makes better copy, you know, to write about the bombs going off and how that causes PTSD, and rather than military sexual trauma, which is, you know, the PTSD is just as bad.
And in your story...
And one, I believe the statistic is that one in every four female service members experiences some form of sexual assault during her service. So you have a whole, you know, demographic of women who are experiencing some form of trauma and sexual trauma, and a lot of times that's either not reported or it's not considered to be PTSD because it's not combat related, but it is PTSD.
In your piece, you guys talk to people who exemplify both sides of this issue, and I was wondering what it was like going or finding the three women that you talked to and convincing them to tell their stories. I mean, was that much of a challenge, or did they really want to get their stories out?
You know, there's various organizations that, you know, like I just mentioned, the Service Women's Action Network, and there's actually, I think I found both of these women through an organization called Under the Hood, which is a cafe in Killeen, Texas. Under the Hood meaning, you know, Fort Hood. It refers to Fort
right.
Hood. And so it's basically a cafe for servicemen and women to come and get help and counseling for a variety of things. I mean, there's people there that kind of just, you know, that don't agree with the reason they're going to war and want to sort of fill in forms for conscientious objector status. There are other people that have got PTSD and don't feel they're getting the help they want. So they all come to this cafe, and this cafe provides outreach and support. So I'd written about them before, so I got in touch with them and managed to find Heather Diamani and Jen Hassin through this cafe. And, you know, I mean, Erin will tell you, I mean, it's I don't know if it's a case of, you don't want to try and persuade somebody to talk about something so difficult, but, you know, as a journalist, I know that, you know, it's incorrect telling somebody that this is gonna help them
right.
by telling their story, because sometimes it doesn't. You
right.
know, sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. But what we do know is that getting stories like this out there in the media helps other people. I mean, that's a given. But Erin, I don't know if you wanted to just mention the homecoming project, where you had to talk to a lot of different servicemen and women that were coming home with different problems
yeah.
and issues.
Yeah.
But how difficult
I've
that
been,
was.
I've been photographing veterans with post-traumatic stress disorder for about 4 years now. So, and I am the director of an organization called the Homecoming Project, which uses visual storytelling to help address issues that veterans are currently facing as they come home from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. So for me, you know, it's kind of, since I'm so heavily involved in the veteran community, it feels really natural to me. I spend a lot of time with the military and veterans. So for me, it was, you know, it was kind of like just another day in my life. But, you know, the two women that I photographed, Jen Hassin and Heather Diamani, they were so open and completely accepting of me being there. And I think that it helps that I am a woman and that I have been to Afghanistan. They feel, to me, they felt pretty at home talking with me from the start. So I feel really lucky to have been in that position.
Do you mind telling us a little bit about your experiences shooting photos in Afghanistan?
Oh, sure. I went to Afghanistan for the first time in 2009 and began covering the war there. My focus has been a variety of different stories, from spending 6 weeks in a cash hospital or combat emergency room and operating room hospital in eastern Afghanistan, to going on patrols with the U.S. military, specifically the 10th Mountain Division, 3rd Brigade Combat Team. So I've been inside the wire and I've been outside the wire on patrols, and I've photographed extensively there from 2009 to 2011. And, you know, I think as an outsider and as a civilian, for me, and as a journalist, my sort of first desire when covering a story is really a satisfaction of understanding and personally getting to view the war up close and understand how it unfolds and how it might be different from my perspective, how it might differ from what we see, what we all see on the television and news. That's sort of, I guess, what initiated me going over there in the first place. As I continued to cover the war, I realized that a whole larger part of the war is the story of U.S. military and veterans coming home and the struggle and the battles that they face once they're stateside, which include post-traumatic stress disorder, traumatic brain injury, and military suicide, which is currently at its highest point in recorded history. About 22 veterans commit suicide each day, which is roughly about one an hour. So, that's been my primary focus over the past couple of years, is talking about their transition, how they're received when they come back, how they have difficulty getting their claims processed by the VA, and what their lives are like after war.
Well, this question is to both of you, and it's sort of looking forward after your story. Is anything being done differently? Or are there any changes that look like that might take place on the horizon to help women veterans?
I mean, the statistics, I mentioned these stats for Service Women's Action Network, and the statistics are getting better. I mean, if you just, as I said, it was worse in 2011 for the Waco VA, for example. But in 2012, it was, those figures are starting to come together, those percentages of the recognition of MST PTSD and combat PTSD are coming together. But it's also worth pointing out that until people realize that actually, I mean, combat PTSD, any PTSD is horrendous, and it's something you have to kind of deal with and survive and recover from. But, I point out in the story, I interview Dr. Frank Ochberg, who is a trauma psychiatrist, in the story, and he points out that what's particularly horrendous about military sexual trauma is there's this fraternity in the military, and this is, he likens it to incest. I mean, this is like your brother doing this to you, because it's your superior officer who you're told to just put your entire life in their hands. And so that's what makes it, I think, worse in some respects than combat PTSD. And then to come back and feel that is not considered as bad as combat PTSD, right. And to see the media talking about combat PTSD and the whiz bang of guns and all the rest of it, but not this devastating thing that can happen to you, military sexual trauma, it sort of adds to the injury, I think. I think that talking about it and the VA accepting this on the same level that they do combat PTSD and treating it the same, then that's what's going to kind of improve the outcomes for the women that are suffering.
One of the tougher things I think that you get at the end of the story is sort of the central question, women are twice as likely as men to have PTSD. Why might that be? And you kind of throw out a couple possibilities. It sounds like no one really knows the answer. And I guess it doesn't really matter if everything's being done to spot PTSD and treat it, wherever it pops up. But I mean, do you have any thoughts or anything that really stuck with you as a likely explanation?
If women are being diagnosed with PTSD because of military sexual trauma, and one in every four female service member experiences some form of sexual assault, then you're right. We know that the numbers are higher than what's being reported. There is a stigma in the military against reporting PTSD, and especially against reporting military sexual trauma or sexual assault. It is honestly, I know both men and women who have been raped in the military, and Alex is right. It is almost worse in the sense that there is this trust and fraternity and sort of brotherhood that's built, and a lot of the a lot of women and men alike are raped by their staff sergeant or someone who is higher up in the ranks who they've trusted and who has guided them during their training and whatnot. So for them to report it, sometimes it actually creates a situation that's much harder on them because the report has to go through the chain of command and then their higher up officer or sergeant or whoever did the actual act is then held responsible. You know, it's very it's hard to get the report to reach the commanding officer, and even if it does, it's normally buried because they don't want that information getting out. And so, yeah, I've talked to a lot of women who just said it's easier to keep it to themselves, which is really unfortunate and sad because it prolongs, you know, the fact that nothing can be done about it. But I feel like with, you know, the story that came out in the Texas Observer, it's stories like those where there are service members and veterans willing to come forward and talk about it that encourages other service members to do the same. And like Jen is amazing to talk to, and she's very courageous, and she sees that her story could inspire other women to be open about their experiences with MST. So, yeah, I think overall it's an issue of it not being reported, and when it is, it gets, you know, it gets buried as quickly as possible.
The story is Hope After Violence. You can read it at texasobserver.org. And Erin, where can I find out more about the Homecoming Project?
If you visit the homecomingproject.org, that's our website. And also, we're on Facebook as well, where we keep updates on our current exhibitions and what we're doing educationally to help create more awareness about military suicide and PTSD.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for being with us, both of you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
We've unfortunately reached the end of this episode, but before we go, I'd like to thank Rosie and the Ramblers for providing our music, and of course, a big thanks to all of you out there listening to us. Observer Radio is recorded at the lovely Co-op Radio Studios in Austin, Texas. Our sound engineer is Tracy Scholes. For more Texas news and culture, you can visit us on the web at texasobserver.org, or you can pick up the latest copy of the Texas Observer at a store near you. We'll talk to you again next time on Observer Radio.